Good evening. Welcome to Shattering Myths. My pleasure to be with you this evening. I know we have the man named after the King of England that created the King James Bible. How are you, James?
I'm doing good.
Great. And we have the...
I was named after my dad, so...
Oh, okay. All right. Well, he was named after the English king. And we have the Antichrist here with us again this evening.
Yes, and as it happens, I was named after Abraham Lincoln.
You were, huh?
Yeah, he was named way before I was. Way before I was.
Oh, goodness. Well, my pleasure to be with you here this evening, guys. For those who don't know what we're talking about in terms of having the Antichrist with us this evening, a couple of days ago on Chattering Myths, Larry called into the show and spoke with Aaron and told Aaron that he was the Antichrist, and we decided to go ahead and play along with the gag. And Larry did a fine job of explaining that, yes, indeed, you and I are both Antichrist.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I hate him.
Yeah,
about him, really.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting with the name Christ. Of course, there was no person named Christ. Christ is not a last name. It's not even a remotely accurate transliteration of the Greek translation of his title. The Greek translation of his title wasn't very good either. But I'm, you know, spending my free time writing a short history of Rome. Now, my short history of Rome is already 188 pages, so it may turn out to be longer than Rome lasted. But during it, I'm now around the Great Fire of Rome. I've done my whole history of Rome. Now I've gone back and trying to flesh out interesting stories. And by the way, it is really filled with interesting stories. I think that even those that don't like history, when you get a chance to read this, you'll enjoy the insights and stories about Rome. But the Great Fire of Rome is interesting as it relates to the misnomer Christ. If it was not for the Great Fire of Rome, we wouldn't have proof that that was not the proper transliteration of the translation of the Masaiah title. It was a fellow named Tacitus who became probably the most famous of all Roman historians. And he was 9 years old when the Great Fire occurred. And so he was 12 years old when Nero decided that he would take some of the land cleared by the Great Fire and build this marvelous garden to himself, with a 100-foot golden statue of himself in the middle of it. And
a bit of an ego there.
Pardon?
I said a bit of an ego there.
Oh, just a touch of an ego. When you study Nero, he was a fairly complex individual. He had this overwhelming desire to be loved. So he did lots of civic projects. Like after the Great Fire of Rome, he was there with his own hands, digging through the ashes, trying to find survivors. He funded much of the reconstruction of Rome. He lessened the taxes on the most impoverished Romans. He participated in a number of civic projects, including establishing charitable entitlements that got the people through the recession that he himself had imposed. He was actually the first to devalue a currency, which was interesting. He reduced the weight of the Roman denarius, and then he reduced the silver purity to pay for the extravagance that he was trying to build in Rome. And he actually built housing projects. You know, everybody didn't get a car in their garage and a chicken in the pot, but they got a portico on the front of their house. But it was in the aftermath of the fire, 3 years later, when Nero is trying to enjoy his garden at night, of course, he would later blame the fire on Jews, not on Christians, on Jews. And he wasn't burning Christians as torches. He was burning Jews as torches. At around 67, 68 CE, the Common Era, Rome had made absolutely no distinction between a Jew and this the followers of Yahusha. As far as they were concerned, they were just all Jews. And Rome hated Jews. So you will kind of go through this whole analysis of when anti-Semitism became so ubiquitous within Rome. But, right after Rome crucified Yahusha, every emperor after that had serious issues, and all of them were overtly anti-Semitic. Like in Rome, for example, you were no longer welcome in Rome if you were Jew. Tiberius was the first to exile all Jews from Rome. He is also the first to say, if you're a Jewish male between the ages of 16 and 46, you need to immediately sign up for a 40-year service to the Roman military. That, by the way, is oppressing your people. So it was really interesting to follow all that. But getting to the point of Tacitus, he's 12 years old when Nero is hanging Jews from crosses. And they weren't crosses in the sense of the Christian sense. They were capital T's. But he was hanging them throughout his garden so that he could illuminate his golden statue of himself at night. And they were Jews. And the reason...
Lovely.
That it, oh, yeah,
lovely guy.
Oh, a lovely guy. Yeah, lovely guy. Yeah. Yeah, he's a guy, by the way, that had his brother murdered, his sister murdered, his mother murdered. He started off with an Oedipus complex and then ended up murdering his mother. He murdered everybody around him.
She didn't reciprocate in this love affair. Okay.
Well, she did for a while, but then he.
Oh, really?
But then he decided that he was going to choose a slave to be his lover. She didn't like that. She was going to put his stepbrother on the throne that she could manipulate more easily. So he killed him, and then he went off and he took his best friend's wife. Which was adultery. She complained about that, so he had her killed. And then later he killed his best friend's wife, but had some necrophiliac tendencies and had her stuffed so he could keep her around.
Whoa!
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
Whoa, Nelly!
Yeah,
well, he was a soldier of Rome. Hold this man up in high esteem. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, people loved him.
Yeah. We get that in all the movies, you know.
Yeah, the Romans loved him. Against this backdrop, and that's part of the reason I'm telling the story of Rome, is because it's important to understand where the Roman Catholic and the Eastern Orthodox Church grew out of, why they were anti-Semitic, why they were so vicious, why they were revisionist with history. Why we have the title Pope. Because, Caligula, for example, applied the title Pope to himself. So we go back, and it's interesting just to see that there's just an outgrowth from one another. But getting back to the Antichrist and the Christ as a name. Tacitus is in his annals, is the first credible, highly credible, secular historian to tell us about what happened to a fellow that he says is referred to by some, and he would be referring to, since he hated Jews, he'd be referring to what the Greeks called him. But the Greeks called him Christus. And so when you're doing your research, one of the things you find is that this Christus is written all over the place. But Tacitus was the first to tell us that the placeholders that were in the eyewitness accounts, they were not for Christos, which means drugged, Christos. They were based on Christus, which is an entirely different word. It's not a different transliteration of the same word. It's an entirely different word. And so rather than Christ meaning drugged, it was Christus, which is a useful and good implement our servant, which is devoted and set apart to duty.
And that was C-H-R-E-S, not
E-S. So E-E-S and U-S. So an E and a U, which, you know, Greek is a very different language than Hebrew. You know, in Hebrew, while there were five vowels and 17 consonants, in Hebrew, the Masoretes saw to it that they said that those vowels were silent, and so then they created their dots to create, you know, the sounds later on. Well, in Greek, the vowels are just vowels. I mean, the E and the I are, you know, are completely different letters, and the U and the O, Christus and Christos, completely different letters. So it's a completely different word, having no commonality whatsoever to Christos. And so the Christians who call themselves Christians based upon Christ are using a title and name that was not used by the first followers of the way. And
no, of course it wasn't.
And it's Tacitus that gives us the absolute proof of this being the case. This Roman historian. And the only reason that Tacitus saw fit to write about the followers of Christus, which he called Christusians, was because of Nero burning the followers of Christus, the Jews, as luminaries to light his giant statue, because, you know, he said that they had burned Rome, so he was going to burn them to light Rome. And Tacitus, who was there at the time, witnessing it, wrote about it, and had he not done so, this, which I think is really a marvelous insight as to Christus versus Christos, we wouldn't know about it had it not been for that fire. So it's all the stuff you can learn, and you know, I just find every affirmation fascinating along the way, and that was one of the more interesting.
Well, I mean, that's a major corruption.
Yeah, it is.
But yeah. I mean, obviously, we all know that. We all know it was Maaseiah. I mean, if they're trying to use Christ as a title, you know, that's ridiculous. And if they're trying to use it as a last name, that's even more ridiculous. So,
yes.
Know, either way.
And it's not only ridiculous in that the placeholders weren't representing Christos, which means that Christus, the Christian and Christ are errant, and that the Greek was Christus, which is a useful and good implement, which is something that you use to do good work, and that's very
the
similar
equivalent
to,
of Maaseiah. Yeah,
yeah, sure. Which means Maase is an implement that does work. It's one of the more interesting Hebrew words for work, and so the work of Yahweh, through the good and useful servant, which was set apart for that. Even a Maaseiah in Hebrew means to be set apart and prepared to complete a mission. And so it's Christus is actually a pretty decent term.
You mean
for
as far
the,
as the
for the whole
thing goes?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. For a translation, it's not bad.
Nomia being a translation for Torah.
Right. Yeah, it's a very interesting translation. You're not going to change Torah to Nomos, just like you're not going to change Maaseiah to Christus. But nonetheless, knowing that Christus was what the placeholder was using, boy, you learn a lot. And it's just really fascinating, I think. It's reaffirming and fascinating, and the whole thing's interesting. I continue to be like most of you, that the more we learn, the more affirmations we find, that it's one story, one God, one Torah, one one message from beginning to end, one family. You know, it's all of it is.
Well, the corruptions are amazing. I mean, you know, what was that sign of the eagle? That was Roman. You know,
yeah, of course.
And we're running around with this eagle sign and,
right.
you know, being
yeah, they were,
Roman.
They were Aquilas. In fact, that is really an interesting part of the whole story, is that the reason that Rome became so angry at Yehuda during the rebellion that began in 66 CE was that one of the factions that participated on behalf of Yisrael in that revolt not only wiped out a legion, but they captured the
Aquila. Took their flag, didn't they? Yeah.
They took the Aquila, which is the eagle, which is their standard. From Rome's perspective, that's like in America, if you were to take the American flag and to burn it or something, or, you know.
Even worse. It was even worse than that.
But vastly, vastly worse. That is correct.
Yeah.
It's the ultimate insult in Rome. And they took the Aquila, and which is the Roman eagle, and that's why Nero then decided, well, this is our response is insufficient. I need to send the meanest dude in all of Rome, and the meanest dude alive in Rome was Vespasian, and that's why he sent Vespasian. And then it turns out that. That in 1 year, during the time of Nero's death in 68, that Rome had four emperors in that 1 year, some of them simultaneously, and Vespasian won, which is why he left his son to finish the job. And his son was brutal. But none of them compare to Trajan, who returned some, 60 years later. It's also just as an interesting aside, maybe this has nothing to do with anything, I chronicled the life in this chapter of what was happening at Rome during each of the major events in Yosha's life, and there is a corresponding and opposite major event happening in Rome during the time that every major event is happening in Yosha's life. And,
Very strange.
Which is weird coincidences. But then as we go through the story, in 66 CE, Rome, when it decides that it's going to pummel the province of Yehuda. And Yehuda rebelled because for Nero to build this great palace and this great colossal statue of himself in gold, he had to radically increase the taxes paid by each province. And there were a lot of provinces that rebelled, and they rebelled in different ways. And Yehuda was one of them. And I'll let you guess, for the first time, what the population was of Rome. And they took a census. What the population of Rome was in 66 CE when they decided to send the legions down.
Let
to,
me guess. 6 million or something.
6 million exactly.
You got it.
Yeah, 6 million exactly. Maybe it's just a coincidence. But there are a whole lot of coincidences all the way through this this story, and the history of Tiberius in particular, who was the emperor at the head of Rome during the time that Rome crucified Yosha. Oh, the parallels between Tiberius's life and Yosha, contrasting the beast and the Messiah, just make your the hair on the back of your arm stand straight up. I think it's worth comparing the history of the beast to Yahweh's condemnation of them It's just amazing the stuff you learn. And you find out that Rome and the churches that grew out of Rome, the Eastern Orthodox and the Roman Catholic Church, are genuinely the antithesis of everything that Yahweh loves.
Yeah.
They are
the very seed of Satan, according to Yahusha. And in addition to that, you got Paul, the Roman citizen, if you will.
Correct.
You know, I mean,
yeah, I think they really do need I'm going to, before we finish this chapter, do a lot more on the fact that not only did Paul come out of Rome, not only did he refer to himself as a Roman citizen, not only did he choose a Roman name, but Paul's thesis, well, he lays the foundation for Pauline doctrine in Galatians. Galatians is a very poorly written letter. The letter that made Paul the founder of Christianity is called Romans. And so there's a real desire to weave that into this whole story, where Paul tells those who are followers of him to obey the government, and he's speaking of Rome. And at the time, you're dealing with Tiberius, that during the time of paralleled Yosha's life, that was, this guy for giggles would throw little kids off cliffs just to watch them flat.
You painted a pretty serious picture of the Roman, you know, elite there. You know, they're sleeping with their mother. The mother's into it.
Then you look at Caligula. Caligula is, you know, after Tiberius, you have Caligula. And Caligula, I mean, the name now is synonymous with perversion. And in his life is...
They did a movie called Caligula, and that's exactly what they were pointing out. This was something 30 years ago or something.
Yeah. And Caligula is perverted as anyone who's ever lived. Claudius came next. Claudius was... Only spared from being the equally perverted because he had a speech impediment. Nobody wanted to be around him. He was lame. And he was spared because he was hiding behind drapes when his predecessor, Caligula, was being killed. But even he was murdered to bring Nero to the throne. And it was his Nero's mother that murdered Claudius. So it's the whole story. It's just absolutely repulsive. So it's worth knowing to contrast why God despises these things. One of the things that's really interesting, by the way, is that it was Caligula that brought the obelisk to Rome that's in the middle of the Vatican. And he did so as the Pope, and claiming to have that statue represent him. He claimed to be Ra, the Egyptian sun god.
Yeah, that's where it said Amun Ra lives. That's why you have that there.
Yeah, that actual obelisk doesn't have hieroglyphics on it. There is a second obelisk that's larger. That was brought to Rome by Constantinus II, which was Constantine's son. And that's the one that is covered in Egyptian hieroglyphics. It's a tribute to Amun-Ra. And the larger of the two obelisks is not in the center of the Vatican. That's the one that was brought in by Caligula. Pope Caligula is in the center of the Vatican. But the one that's got all of the hieroglyphics proclaiming the deity of Amun-Ra, it is in Rome. It is in the Vatican. I'll give you guys one guess as to where it is. The Vatican is comprised essentially of three elements. There's that huge square that's kind of almost like the Roman circus where Caligula's obelisk is. Then you've got St. Peter's, which has a statue of, which by the way was a temple to Jupiter. It was a converted temple to Jupiter St. Peter's was. And the statue outside of it of Peter is actually a statue of Jupiter. And so it's not there. There's a third element of the Vatican, the papal residence.
That's where it is.
That is where it is. It's right out front of the papal residence.
Very fitting.
Yes, Amun-Ra. Brought in by the first official Christian emperor and pope of Rome. By the way, Constantine declared himself pope too. But it's and their term is Father of Fathers, Patre of Patres. But it was brought in by the first Christian emperor of Rome, Constantine's son, and it was brought in to beautify one of his palaces that has subsequently become the papal palace. It doesn't matter what rock you turn over. There is just no question at all that the living manifestation of the beast today is the Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox Church.
Oh, absolutely it is. Absolutely it is. What's amazing to me, I mean, this is all out there, all out front. I had a YouTube video the other, 6 months ago. They've taken it down. But literally, they said they were having an Ishtar celebration. It was on Easter. And they were saying that glorious Christ had risen, the son of Lucifer. He can never die. The son of Lucifer, they said it right in their song. They were, a bunch of cardinals were singing it. You know, and you can put this stuff out there. You can put it right in front of people's face. They refuse to believe it.
Some other just fun things that you get. It's hard to believe, but it's nonetheless true. You mentioned Lucifer. I told you Tiberius is the Antichrist. Tiberius's life and every act in Tiberius's life sets up an absolute parallel with everything in Yosha's life. Guess who? Well, Tiberius was off on the Isle of Capri, being a pedophile and tossing little. After he had sex with his victims, he tossed them off the cliff to see them bounce off the rocks. Guess what the name was of the man that he left in charge of Rome while he was this murderous pedophile? Lucius.
You tell me. No clue.
Lucius.
Lucius.
It means shining light. It's the exact same base as Lucifer. And we have Lucifer only because of the Latin Vulgate, because the Latin Vulgate wrote the name of Satan as Lucifer, the light bearer.
Instead of Paul Ben Shakar.
What's interesting, too, is that Lucius, who is a demonic character, and Lucius is clearly the influence behind Tiberius, who is clearly demon possessed. I mean, he's far worse than Caligula. Tiberius is. Lucius is killed, and the year that he's killed is the year that Yosha is out in the wilderness meeting with Satan. Same year. And you just go, whoa.
You know, it's all out there. And then, you know, you get more, you know, the people in the United States would be shocked if they understood what we were mirroring here. You know, I mean, the Roman flags and the eagles and all the other nonsense. And
hey,
I've got another one for you.
The revolt that started in 66 CE with the 6 million Romans, based upon funding the golden colossal statue of Nero. The Roman legions administrator at the time, who started it by stealing about 60 shekels from the temple treasury. He had a very interesting name. It's spelled with a G as opposed to a J. But guess what his name was?
Could that be Jesus?
Jesus. His name was Jesus. Absolutely. This was the Roman that robbed the treasury and that worked to get a statue of the Roman emperor put inside of the temple. Yep. His name was Jesus. The whole thing, you can't believe the next rock you're going to turn over and what you're going to find lurking underneath it. And the sad thing, of course, for Jews is during this particular period that they were being prejudiced against is that there were such a small percentage of them that actually knew Yahweh. Most of them were religious zealots. And so really God didn't have one side or the other. I think he felt sorry for his children, but at the time they were estranged from him, and I'm sure that he grew to hate Rome. It's obvious that he hates Rome. It was a pretty awful time. All right, turning to Psalm 119. We're going to start with the 70th statement, and 70th I broke into two segments, and the first segment of it we covered in our program yesterday at this time. And the first half of it is...
That was last week at this time.
Yeah, last week. And
I'm trying to straighten you out here. Okay.
Oh, you know, did I say something other than that?
You said
that
yesterday.
Long? Oh, yesterday. Oh, well, so that probably won't be the worst. It probably will not be the worst mistake I'll make today.
Go ahead.
nor tomorrow. You know, it begins with the with calloused and incapable of feeling, indeed unresponsible and gross, are the hearts of these who are like fatty oils. He is telling us that he is not really fond of those who mock his devotion to Yahweh and his affinity for Yahweh's word. So he's telling us that they're oil and water, and that they, from God's perspective, he's inspired by God, that they're gross. So he transitions from that to your Torah, is actively engaged in my life because I delight in it and I find it totally enjoyable. So this is really just, it's a very simple statement. It's Torah, prefaced by the second person masculine singular, your Torah, speaking of Yahweh's Torah. And then it's just one more word. So it's Torah Sha'ah. And so you might say, well, how in the world am I getting from your Torah, which is the first word, and then Sha'ah to is actively engaged in my life because I delight in it and I find it totally enjoyable? Well, Sha'ah was scribed in the first person singular masculine, speaking of I here, speaking, this is Dode speaking, or you can speak it, we can speak it in first person I. And then it means, Sha'ah means to delight in, to find something totally enjoyable. But it was written in the in a very unusual stem, which is the papel stem, almost never found. I mean, it's one of those you come across it and say, boy, I'm going to have to take some time to figure out what this one means. But it speaks of something that is not passive but active. And it's a relational stem that means that Dode is actively engaged in this process of finding delight, that he is totally immersed in the joy that is associated with the Torah. So your Torah is actively engaged in my life because I find delight in it. I find it totally enjoyable. Today on Shattering Myths, I asked IQ to follow me through a process of explaining who perpetrated 9/11, but not from preparation, not from the head, but from the heart. And the idea was to come to an appreciation of the fact that knowledge that you have in your head is beneficial, but it's not nearly as powerful as that which you embrace in your heart. And we in today's world, we think of the heart from an emotional point of view, but that's not what it meant back in the day. Something that you observed with your eyes, which means you read, so that you came to know the information that was contained in the document, and then you thought about it, making connections, you came to understand it. And then once you came to understand it, you say, wow, I really like this. This makes sense to me. I want to hold on to this. And when you take it from that point and you try to incorporate what you've learned and come to understand into your life, then it flows out of your heart. The way that this was written, at Torah Sha'ah, what it says is that the Torah has been brought into Dode's life, and it flows out of his life, and that it is part of his makeup now. And that he is now an extraordinarily joyful, happy person, expressly because of the influence of the Torah in his life. That's pretty impressive stuff. When you reach the point that the Torah brings you joy, then you've reached the point that we find Dode in. Oh. I find the Torah joyful. Now, I'm going to be honest. I don't spend a lot of time in Numbers and Bamidbar. You know, I know that I could find joy in that, because if you take the names and you translate the names and you put the names in order when he's talking about something, you'll find that every nuance of it is enlightening. But, you know, I'll be honest. I find Bereshith more fun. I find Shemot, Exodus, a lot more fun. I find great joy and fun in learning about the invitations to meet with God and the Yobel that are presented in Kara. And I think Darbadim is probably the most interesting presentation. You know, if I were to take the whole of Yah's testimony, it's pretty hard to beat Darbadim. That's why Yosha quoted it the most. I think I'm like you guys. I find that by incorporating the Torah into my life, I have brought great joy into my life.
Pretty much every aspect is
most definitely
goes against the tradition of religion. It's kind of interesting. I did a post here this week about people going to grave sites so they can go talk to whoever that's dead, you know, and how Yahweh put such an emphasis on it, we don't even know where Moshe was buried. You know, I mean, it was such a non-starter graveyards, you know.
Right. In fact, God's idea is that, you know, you just wrap
where
the body,
Adam
put
buried.
It away in a tomb, and you just don't care. Here is, and they're mourning a loved one, and they're hopeful they're going to see that loved one in heaven. And I think that false hope there to assuage their emotional loss is such a travesty to give people.
Well,
I think
they go there
to
talk to them. They
yeah,
say
I
so. I
but giving people
goodbye,
the false hope that they're.
And I said, and all this other nonsense. It just
that these people are in heaven and that they're going to meet them again. It is so cruel to give people false hope. I mean, it's like telling people that, you know, there's this river of molten lava that is flowing, but that I've created this bridge over the lava. You can't see the bridge. It's an invisible bridge. And I don't want you to pay any attention to people walking off the edge of this cliff and screaming, and you get the illusion that they're falling into the lava. It's only because their faith is not great enough. If you believe that I have this invisible bridge across this flowing lava, you're going to be fine. Now, I'm going to tell you, You're giving them false hope. And by the way, I'm telling you that those who have died before you, they're on the other side. They're waiting for you. They're singing for you to come across.
Yeah, yeah. You know, but funerals become such a large part of religion, you know, any religion. You know, funeral. And, of course, that's apropos because religion equals death. It's no wonder it's such a major part of any religion is a funeral.
Yeah.
I don't care what religion you're
there
in.
There is a reason that the Torah is celebrated in our lives. One of the reasons is that we never, ever have to be concerned over death. We never have to worry about where somebody is after death. We have a solution for death in the Torah. But, and that's a nice thing. Yeah, that's a, you know, as things go, it's knowing that you for certain where you're going to spend eternity and with whom you're going to spend eternity, I'd say that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's just there's not much of an emphasis put on funerals in the Torah.
There's no emphasis put on funerals. None. So
because
that's
the one ever mentioned.
I don't think there is one ever mentioned.
Well, that's my point here. I'd say not much of one. I mean, there's none. I mean, if a funeral was so important, why didn't they have a big one for Moshe? I mean, really? I mean, you know, you would have had...
Or Abraham.
600,000 people marching.
Or Yosha.
Well, yeah, I know. It's all of them. But, I mean, you know, go right to the Torah and look at Moshe, and I mean... Wow,
where was the funeral for any of these guys? There wasn't. Anyway,
Adam, Noah.
The reason the Torah is so much fun is not just because it resolves the issue of death making you life. It's not just that, okay, we all know we have flaws, and I don't have to wallow in my flaws anymore because I know that God sees me as perfect. That's a really good thing. I think that the joy of the Torah is knowing Yahweh. I think if you really just get down to what is the fundamental aspect of the Torah that is joyous, it's knowing Yahweh.
Well, it's knowing that his nature is in complete opposition to everything we've ever been told, isn't it?
Yeah, because what we've been told about him isn't very appealing. But what we learn about him is extraordinarily appealing. He is approachable. He's lovable.
Well,
He's just unbelievably loving, caring, consistent, beckoning us into his arms. He's Dad, and he is the antithesis of a Lord. And so coming to know Yahweh as Dad, as approachable, as loving, as being on his knees, reaching... out to us to lift us up because he wants to enjoy our company. Getting to know him, I think, is the ultimate joy of the Torah. That's why his introduction of who he is such an essential part of the Torah, and it's why the covenant relationship is such an essential part of the Torah. Getting to know who he is and being part of his family, that's the joy of the Torah.
Well, I mean, he's right out front, right away. I mean, you know, when he talks about kneeling down and breathing Nesama into Adam's nostrils. I mean, he didn't do that for the purposes of Adam becoming a religious instrument. He said for the purposes of association and companionship.
Exactly.
You know, and right there from the start, you see, oh, okay, so Yahweh has no interest in religion.
Since you mentioned Adam, there is another aspect of the Torah that we find great joy in that was the part of the Torah that I think that Dode celebrated the most. And that is that when Yahweh created Adam for the purpose of relationship, the first thing that we learn about Adam and Yahweh is them sitting down together and the animals being paraded in front of Adam, and then them coming up with names for the animals, and then talking about the animals, and God is showing off his handiwork to his son. And he's having a great time showing off his handiwork to his son, and they're talking about it. And so he was taking his son on a voyage of discovery. about the single most interesting thing in the universe, which is life. And there they're having a relationship over this camping out together, celebrating the wonder of life. And, you know, that is what Dode is doing. That's what we're doing. When we study his testimony, we're going on this marvelous voyage of discovery, enjoying his companionship as we celebrate life. The book of life, and here we are celebrating it. That's what Dode found so delightful. Now, this next statement is another statement that I highlighted in red when I, you know, Larry, you wrote me and you had a somebody was in Convenient Truth that was telling you there's a lot of places in the 119th Psalm that have the word do in it. And so
right,
the second,
yes.
This is the...
Of course,
the
it's next, unpopular truth. We're not affiliated with Albert Gore and his inconvenience.
Okay, unpopular truth. Okay. My second mistake for the evening.
It's getting bad over here, man.
It is getting bad, yep.
I don't want to be associated with Albert, okay?
No. So in the 71st statement of the 119th Psalm, you've got the second application, the second deployment of the Hebrew word for do, which is asha. Now, the first time we found it, it was in the 60-something verse, and the do was being wasn't anything that Dode was doing. It wasn't anything that Yahweh was asking Dode to do. It was something that Yahweh was doing. So there, the first time we come across "do" in the 119th Psalm, it's in the 60th verse, right around there, and it's Yahweh is the one that's doing the doing, and what he's doing is standing up for fulfilling his promises. He's walking the walk in addition to talking the talk. But here's now the second time we have the Hebrew verb for "do." It is good and beneficial for me. Good and beneficial is one of my favorite Hebrew words, tob. It's generous, wonderful, a beautiful thing.
Part of the Torah, the
yeah,
words
fact,
that
yeah, well, it
the
calls
Torah.
The Torah tob.
A base word, yep.
Yeah, well, not only does tob begin have two of the three letters in tob, and two of the three are in Torah. Yahweh says Torah Tob. He equates his Torah to the Hebrew word Tob. Good, beneficial, generous, wonderful, pleasant, fun, beautiful. That's Tob. So it's good. It's beneficial. It's wonderful. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. It's generous. That indeed you responded, providing your testimony, Anah. Now, Anah is in my top 10 favorite Hebrew words.
Yeah,
Anah,
because it's often written, humbled and afflicted and
right,
so
right.
forth when it shouldn't
yes.
be.
Yeah. But can you imagine here, you're going to say, it is good and beneficial for me that indeed were afflicted, that you afflicted, debased yourself.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
You, and he was afflicted, but was he debased and demeaned for the purpose of teaching us how to respond? No.
No.
No. So it is good and beneficial for me that indeed you responded. That's what Anah means, to respond, providing your testimony, that you answered, proclaiming a thoughtful and truthful witness, communicating the information required to answer questions and engage in this marriage. It was written in the Pool Perfect. For the purpose of Ma'an, for the express reason. Ma'an means, okay, I've made a statement, now I'm telling you the reason for that statement. The reason is, in this case, Lamad. Lamad is one of several Hebrew words that means teaching. the unique aspect of Lamad beyond just teaching is it's teaching that enables a proper response. So, it is good and beneficial for me, selfishly, good and beneficial for me, that indeed you responded, providing your testimony, for the purpose of teaching me how to properly respond to, and this is Choke, your engraved and clearly communicated prescriptions of what I should do in life to be cut into this relationship. So, this is powerful stuff here. This is God engaging on our behalf, and here's Dode acknowledging it. It's good for me, and we can say this ourselves. It's good for us that indeed Yahweh responded, providing his testimony for the purpose of teaching us how to properly respond to his inscribed and clearly communicated prescriptions on how to be cut into the relationship choke.
Yeah, well, most people don't even know what the choke is. It's kind
no,
of
no. No, and that's one of the reasons why I really like the 119th Psalm. It goes out of its way to present, really, there's four concepts. There's three of them that are super important. But let's take all four of them. Choke is one of the four. Choke is a Hebrew word that speaks of that which is chiseled in stone, which is that which is inscribed, that which is engraved. So he's not just talking about words that you would chisel in stone. He's not just talking about testimony and tablets that you would inscribe. But by saying that it's chiseled in stone, choke, he's saying that it's not changing. You know, it's really tough to pull out the eraser when you chisel something in stone. It means it's dependable. It's enduring. And it's chiseled into the very bedrock, the very foundation. So chiseled in stone, choke, inscribed, means Yahweh's written testimony that is never changing, that is, you can depend on it, that it's cut right into the face of the foundation. And then the second is that to be choke is to be cut into something. It's a cognate of karat, and which is to cut the covenant. So choke is to be cut into a relationship. What a marvelous term.
Yeah, like we see in Yirmiyahu 31:31, where he's talking about cutting a relationship.
You know, exactly.
Cutting into a relationship.
Right. And that's what choke is all about. So choke is a real powerful term. You know, the other terms are mitzvah, which is the terms and conditions of the covenant. The mishpat, which is the means that Yahweh uses to resolve our disputes. And then the pakudim, which are the prescriptions that enable a proper response. And his entire expose on the Torah highlights those four concepts as to what he's celebrating. It's what he's learning from. It's what he's come to understand. He wanted to observe the Torah the same way that Dode did, which will probably put you in a pretty good position, since Dode, from Yahweh's position, perspective, is not only beloved, but he's the favorite person in all of creation. So I got a hunch that if you observe the Torah the same way he does, you're going to be in good shape. And Dode's focus was coming to understand what those four words meant as they relate to the Torah. So here is Dode recognizing, it is good and beneficial for me. It's generous, it's wonderful, it's a beautiful thing for me, that indeed you responded, Ana, providing your testimony for the purpose of teaching me how to properly respond to your engraved and clearly communicated inscribed prescriptions of what I should do to be cut into the relationship. This does a number of things that I think are really good for us. Yahweh equates his Torah to Tob. And Dode is making it personal. He's saying that the part of the Torah that is Tob good is what it does for me. But I think that God even wants us to be selfish in this regard. He gave us the Torah for our benefit. And Dode's saying, yeah, I think it's really good. Look what the benefits it provides me. And then you get to Ana, which is since Anna is such an extraordinarily important part of the invitations to meet with God, because it's if you have an invitation, you're expected to answer the invitation and to come into the presence of the person who is inviting you to meet with him. Anna is that response. Anna is the response. It is our answer to the invitation. And here, Anna is defined for us in this context. And it's a really important word because God's got seven invitations each year for us to meet with him, and Anna's an integral part of them. It's described here for us. You know, if you do your homework, if you open your eyes, if you go where the words lead, you now have that extraordinary important word defined for us.
Yeah, well, you're, I mean, you're answering an invitation. That's what that outreached hand's all about. You're either going
right.
to answer the invitation or you're going to do what everybody else does. You know, just blow it off.
And
you know?
Here, then, what you have is an affirmation of the obvious. And I like it when the obvious is affirmed. I mean, I came to understand what Anna meant and translated it as other than afflict because of the fact that of the word's etymology. But still...
Well, that changes that changes everything, especially when you're looking at what the corruptions that you find in days like Kippurim, where they go out and they afflict themselves by not eating. When Shag clearly is a celebration. Now, how do you have a celebration at the same time you're starving yourself?
Right. Well, beyond that, Kippurim means reconciliation.
Yeah, I know.
Kippur means to reconcile. To reconcile a relationship is to make it good. Is to make that relationship really harmonious. And unless you're into S&M, if you think you can reconcile your relationship after you've had a squabble with your spouse by afflicting yourself or her, but I want to tell you that is not going to work.
It's a twisted concept, isn't it?
Right, of course. But here now, relative to the Torah, Dode has used Anah, which is an extraordinarily important term for us to understand relative to the seven invitations, and he's used it in a way that defines it for us and affirms its definition. And then he says that Yahweh's response, his answer, was for the express purpose of teaching us how to properly respond, which means that the Torah is comprised of teaching that enables us to respond. Not laws to obey, teaching to respond. And what does God want us to learn how to properly respond to? His covenant, which is why choke was used here. Your Torah, or the Torah, of your mouth is better and more prosperous for me than thousands of gold and silver coins. Now, this is the antithesis of Rome, let me tell you. This is the antithesis of the Roman Catholic Church. They devalue the Torah, but they value the gold and silver coins. The Torah was made illegal by Tiberius. And yet from Yahweh's or Dode's point of view, it was far more valuable than, you know, Tiberius scammed his way to a personal fortune of the equivalent of 3 billion Roman silver coins. The Roman silver coins were about 4 grams apiece. And he had 4 billion of them.
Wow.
Or 3 billion of them, I should say. I don't want to exaggerate. He had 3 billion of them. He had 3 billion of these silver coins. And that's what was meaningful to him. And he made the Torah illegal, devaluing it, and he instead accumulated these coins. And he was so miserable that he got his jollies out of having pedophilic sex with little boys and then
throwing them off the cliffs
so that he could watch them die.
You said that was on the island of Capri?
Yeah, the island of Capri.
I've been there about 20 times, so it was right there. Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. His home on the island of Capri was called the Villa Jupiter, the home of Jupiter.
Well, that would make sense.
Yeah, it would make sense. But from Doe's perspective, and I'm going to share this from my perspective, the single most valuable thing in the universe is the Torah. It is the greatest treasure in the universe. If you could have all of the treasure in the universe or the Torah, if you chose the Torah, you would be the wealthiest individual in the universe. If you could trade, let's just say you had a chance to have either Bill Gates' wealth or the Torah.
I'll take the Torah.
Well, it's easy to say. I think most people would go the other way. I mean, clearly, the Torah is what's enriching. The Torah is what's going to make you to the point where you don't need money. I mean, these things are meaningless to you.
You want to bring great joy into your life? Come to know Yahweh through the Torah. You want to be miserable? Accumulate a great fortune. You want to die fabulously rich? Seek to own many shares of large companies. If you want to die poor, if you want to die rich, embrace the inheritance of the Torah.
Well, yeah, that's clear. You know, we take it for granted too. Just something that kind of hit me. You know, here you got Dode going on and on about, you know, you've revealed your Torah to me. Well, you know, Yahweh's revealed his Torah to everybody. You know,
that's
he didn't
correct.
Really have to.
No.
I mean,
I think he did. I think he did.
Well,
I think he had to.
Yeah, to get what he wanted, which is relationship, he had to. But
he had no choice. He had to.
You know, my point is...
What he didn't have to do is reveal the prophets to us. What the prophets do is help us understand the Torah, help us understand his timeline, help him understand him, help us understand what's coming, understand what's happened in the past, help us have greater conviction in our relationship. And the prophets help us a lot, but... He didn't have to give us the prophets. He had to give us the Torah.
You gotta imagine that he's the religious deity Allah. Okay.
Yeah.
Just imagine that.
Yeah, I don't like that. Okay.
No, I'm.
Yeah.
Just imagine Allah writing his Torah. Okay.
Right.
He wouldn't bother because he doesn't really want a relationship with people. That's my point here.
Yeah.
You know, it's
but there are, and I don't have any discomfort saying that there are things that God has no choice in. Once he created humankind, he had to reveal his Torah. Was no longer an option. I would even go so far as once he revealed his Torah and he'd created humankind, he had to inspire this song.
Well, either way.
I don't think he had a choice. I think he had to inspire the song to tell us how to maximize our benefit from the Torah. And I think he had to provide us with the Torah. And the Torah is the greatest treasure in the universe. If you're an informed individual and a rational individual, and you were given the choice between the combined wealth of the richest men who've ever lived and this one document, you would be vastly, infinitely better off with this one document.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, otherwise you're Faust out there making a deal with the devil. I mean, you're stupid. You're going to go down, you know.
Well, one way you're going to die, and typically the life of the wealthy is a life of paranoia because they view that everybody's trying to get them, and they are. And they're miserable.
That's true.
And they're miserable. You know, there's a difference between, I guess it's not really paranoia when they really are out to get you. And if you're a fabulously wealthy person, they are all out to get you, to take advantage of you. So I don't know if it's really it's not paranoia at that point, but it's a miserable experience. That's why most of the really what rich people are recluses. They don't want public association because people are so... covetous of what they have.
Yeah, and you know, we know a lot of the stories, like Howard Hughes would be an example.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And just right. An insane, went nuts in a hospital bed environment, growing his nails. And probably, you know, who knows? He thought everybody was out to get him, that's for sure.
Yep. Yeah, well, here's another do passage. It says, by the way, we have made a transition, and I would be remiss if I didn't tell you what the transition was to. It is to the stanza that is on probably the single most important letter in the Hebrew alphabet. It's called a yod today, but it's a yod. It's Yahweh's hand. It's the first letter of Yahweh's name, the first letter of Yahusha's name. This section, these eight statements, begin with yadid, which is the plural of yod, which means hands. And so this begins, yadid, your hands.
Of course, a yod is a hand.
A yod is a hand. Yeah, a yod. The letter is named after the Hebrew word for hand, and it was drawn as a open hand at the end of a outstretched arm, an arm that is coming down and out with an open hand, which is someone who is bigger than we are, reaching down and out to us with an open hand. That's how the letter was drawn. And there are two primary ways that you can draw a hand, open and closed. And the symbolism different between open and closed is gargantuan. Open hand is handshake.
Accepting.
Open hand is reach out and grasp you. It's available. It's open. The closed hand is a fist. It's I'm going to strike you. It communicates fear. The other one communicates love.
Yeah, the closed hand would be, as an example, the Marxist fist.
Correct. You know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And
it's like the difference between Yahweh and Stalin. I mean, it's
right.
It's insane
when
difference.
When your children, most of us have are parents, and we've had young children. When you reach down to a young child, do you ever reach down to your child with a closed fist?
No.
No. If you're going to go greet a friend, do you go greet the friend with a closed fist? No.
No.
You reach out to your friends and you reach down to your children with an open hand. That's the yod. So this is an important letter. It's the first letter in Yahweh's name. It is the only letter that Yahusha mentioned. You know, he was talking about the Torah, and he said he was talking about how we read it in from the Greek influence, the jots and the tittles.
Yeah.
Well, it's
mm-hmm.
actually the yods and the tittles. The tittles were the strokes of Hebrew letters. Any Hebrew letter that has particularly a crown stroke on it, which is a lot of them. The tittles are the tiniest strokes on the letter, and the yod is the smallest of the Hebrew letters, which just tells you a lot about God. You know, he took the smallest letter to start his name. But it's the only letter that Yahusha mentioned when he said that, you know, not a single yod or stroke of a Hebrew letter is going to be annulled, is going to be done away with, so long as the heavens and earth exist. And so this is the one letter of the 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet that he called out by name to say, this letter is going to continue to be meaningful, to continue to be astoundingly important, and cannot be ignored or erased so long as the heavens and earth exist. So why do you think that he picked this one letter as the example of, you know, I'm telling you that this letter, this one, is going to exist so long as the heavens and earth exist and cannot be expunged from the Torah and the prophets. You know, why did he pick this letter?
I think because Yahweh begins with Yod. And
yeah.
Further, I think
that's
also he knew that they were going to try to replace it with J, as in Jehovah, as in Jesus.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do think that Yahweh starting with a Yod, and that they were going to do everything they could to remove Yahweh's name from his testimony. I think that's half of it. Maybe it's two-thirds of it, because you've got two components there. that Yahweh's name begins with the Yod, and also that he knew that his name and Yahweh's name were going to have that Yod, the Yod, the Y, replaced with a J. So he knew both of those two things. So let's say that's two-thirds of it. I'm going to say there's another part of it, and that's what you only know if you think about what the letter means. You've got to think to come to this other part.
Well, it's an outstretched hand. It's an invitation. It's a lot of things. You know,
yes.
Sure.
It's God reaching down to lift us up. It's the invitation. It's the outstretched arm of God to lift us up, to grab us by the hand so that we can be together.
And you see that in the very next letter, the hey and the name, because those are people standing up with their arms up, reaching, and he's reaching down with that hand. Yeah, sure, Yahweh, you know,
now,
God, hey,
who is the hand of Yahweh?
Who's the hand of Yahweh?
Yeah.
That would be Yahusha.
That would be correct. That would be correct. He's the hand of Yahweh. And he's even saying that he's going to exist so long as the heavens and the earth exist. And
yeah, he calls himself the right hand. It's
right,
right there.
Exactly.
You know, I mean,
exactly.
Yeah.
So he's the living manifestation of the hand of God. And it is. And without the hand of God, we don't exist. And so long as the heavens and earth exist, we need the hand of God to lift us up. He is the means for us to arrive in his company and to be part of his family and to grow as his children and to go explore the universe together. If you come to know Yahweh based upon the symbol of the hand, then you get it. You really do. You get it. A God reaching down and out with an open hand can't be feared. That's not a God trying to beat you down. That's a God trying to lift you up. And once you recognize that he's doing that, and you recognize how we as parents respond to our children when they're down and we try to lift them up, you get it. At that point, if you really understand why he said that that Yod cannot be done away with so long as the heavens and earth exist, then you get it. That is the answer. Little detail, big importance.
No, that's a profound thought. I mean, you're right. He's described as the right hand of Yahweh, you know. So the physical and that's the physical manifestation of Yahweh. So there it is.
Yep.
Period.
He is Yahweh on his knees, lifting us up. So your hands have accomplished the work required to conceive and create me. And also, they have formed and fashioned me to be firmly established and appropriately directed. So please, help me develop the mental acuity to be observant and understand. And then I really want you to teach me how to respond properly to the terms and conditions of your relationship agreement. So, your hands, the living embodiment of the Word of God, is the hand of God, that is Yahusha. It is Yahweh who reached out to us to literally to etch this testimony in stone. Hand in Hebrew conveyed the idea that he has the power and authority to accomplish what needs to be done. Yahweh didn't just talk the talk, he walked the walk. Because he blazed that trail of the meeting times, of those seven meetings, and he himself did all of the work, all we have to do is follow along. So your hands have accomplished the work required to conceive me and create me. Now, when he's talking about his conception, he's talking about hands symbolically. You know, Yahweh talked us into existence. He calculated us into existence. He didn't, take the clay and form us that way. But he did have to use his hands to lift us up to blow the breath of life and the nesama into us. But he's speaking of hands there as you have the authority, you have the power, and the means to do this. Then he says, and also they have formed and fashioned me to be established and appropriately directed. Kun is extraordinarily similar to Kum. And Kum, like Kum, means you made me upright. You made me so I can stand.
Kumbaya.
Exactly. And this is the Kum with a K versus a Q. And there's subtle differences between the two. You know, to Kum is to be established standing, where Kun is to be formed and fashioned in an appropriate way. But both of them convey the concept of the appropriate way is to be standing. So he's talking about here a very profound idea that is, I think, is as important as understanding the Yod and Yahweh's name, is understanding the two Hays and Yahweh's name. God fashioned Homo sapiens to be unlike every other animal. And the two primary differences, if you will, between Homo sapien, Adam, and Chawa, and every other animal, is that we stand upright. We don't walk on all fours. We stand upright. God specifically designed us, Kun, to stand upright. And he's doing so because of the nature of the relationship he's trying to achieve with us. And the other thing that he gave us that he didn't give it to any other animal is a hand with opposable thumbs. Because we could do marvelous things with our hands, including reach down and picking up our children, just as he can reach down and pick us up. Those are the two unique aspects of Homo sapiens, the opposable thumb in the hand and what we can do, that we can write, we can turn the pages. Yes, of course, he gave us the Nesama. And so here you have God inspiring Dode to understand that God created us specifically so that he could use his hand to lift us up so we could stand with him. And it's why there are two people standing in the middle of Yahweh's name.
This is also like, you know, when we see the counterfeits of religion, everybody's prostrate or on their knees or bowing or, you know, something like that. Because that's the curse of religion, and that's Satan loves that. He loves
God specifically designed us to be upright. And that's a powerful concept. If you're upright with God, you're not afraid of him. If you're upright with God, you're engaged. You're shoulder to shoulder, eye to eye, heart to heart, side by side. And when you're, you know, it's really hard to make much progress when you're on your knees. But you want to go off and explore. You want to go take a camping trip and see new stuff. You're a lot better off on your feet.
Yeah, there are places where people greet each other on their knees. It's called prison, you know.
Yep.
And I'm just, you know, I mean, really, just every aspect of religion flows out of submission and fear.
Yeah, in fact, I would ask you a question, Larry. If you're on your knees, you know, your head is aligned with your spine, and you're on your knees. Does the view ever change?
No.
But if you're on your feet and you're engaged, you can look around and you can see vast panoramas. The view is always changing. Even when you're looking at the same view, just the light's changing on that view.
Yeah, and of course, as we get into the next stanza, we're going to get Yira used, you know, which is respect. And, you know, of course, in the religious material, it's going to say fear, I'm sure. You know, so,
yep,
right back to that.
Your hands have accomplished the work required to conceive and create me, and also they have formed and fashioned me to be firmly established and appropriately directed, upright. So please, help me develop the mental acuity to be observant and understand. Bien. Bien, again, is in my top 10 favorite Hebrew words. Bien has two related connotations that most people would never even bother to notice. Bien is used all the time, like when Yahweh is talking to Abraham about the covenant, and he's going on about this relationship between he and Abraham, and he and Jacob, and he and Yishak, and the children of Israel. He uses Bien all through that, and it's just translated. You know, it's between you and me, you know, being between, making a connection between you and me, being. But that's not the primary connotation of being. But it explains why being is the Hebrew word for understanding. Because when you make connections between things, that's when you come to understand. And I've, intuitively, all my life, I've known that. I've understood the process of understanding, which is to make connections. And I'm going to celebrate this, and I'll be a little, just a bit self-centric here for a moment, because I want to share something that is profoundly joyous for me. And that is that when you make the connections between things that people miss, like today I'm going through Tiberius's life, and I was just motivated to say, I want to layer on the time and the events that he's doing, the names of the people and the places with the events in Yosha's life. And I made a connection between them. And all of a sudden there was profound understanding. It is making connections that causes us to understand it. And the more all of us can do that, is to make connections so that we understand, the more enlightened we're going to be, the more joyous we're going to be, the more fun we're going to have. And so God chose a word for understanding that was based upon, that explained the process of understanding, making connections. I'll give you a great example. We just did it 10 minutes ago. We said, why did Yahweh choose to only name one letter in the Torah that says that letter is going to continue to endure and be important so long as the heavens and earth exist?
Sure.
Well, the only way that we...
easy to understand. I mean, yeah. You know, if you understand what the yod is, you get it right away.
Right.
Sure.
So then you have to make a connection, right? That's what we're doing. And then when I said, who is the hand of Yahweh? What's the first thing you did, Larry? You made a connection, right? I said, yeah, I'm the right hand. Right? It's connections that open our eyes. It's connections that causes us to understand. And until you understand, you really can't trust and rely.
Right, and this is just one small. Here we're in a yod talking about one little small thing, you know, and you're going through a picture in your mind, right? I mean,
right.
You are, yeah. You know, and the whole Torah is like that.
It's you know,
wild.
There is one vowel, which is an open mouth sound, in Bien. Guess what letter it is?
That would be Yod.
Yeah, absolutely. And the first letter in it is Beyeth, which means family.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, it's written as a little home. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is extremely powerful kinds of things that God is enabling us to make these kind of connections and to ultimately come to understand precisely who he is and what he's offering us. And, you know, it is absolutely marvelous stuff. And
actually took every word and made a little pictorial out of it, they would all become that interesting. More than likely.
Yeah. That's all true. All right, so he goes on to say, your hands have accomplished the work required to conceive and create me, and also they have formed and fashioned me to be firmly established and upright. So please help me develop the mental acuity to make the proper connections to transition between being observant and understanding. And then I really want you to teach me how to respond properly to the terms and conditions of your relationship agreement. Is not Dode thereby telling us that if you want to observe the Torah, learn from it?
Right. Yeah, that's exactly what he's saying. Right.
And when you learn from it, come to understand what's being said, and then when you come to understand what's being said, respond to the terms and conditions of the covenant?
Yeah, what it's that's what it's all about. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so it has nothing to do with obeying a law. It has everything to do with understanding the teaching. Yeah, those things, I really want you to teach me. I want to continue to learn. I'm eager to understand. Because you made me in such a way that
I can observe your. He didn't say, let me observe your laws. Talk about, you know, that really takes a bite out of it, doesn't it?
Oh, of course, imagine this.
I mean,
what I really want to do is I want to obey your laws, and your obeying your laws brings such joy to my heart.
Yeah.
You know, if I sit here and obey your laws, I'm going to become so smart. I can't imagine the thrill of you teaching me your laws so that I understand. I mean, it's just so convoluted and twisted.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're bringing it down to the ludicrous. I mean, and it is ludicrous.
But it is ludicrous.
Yeah. But that's what you see in all the religious material nonsense like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I could write that.
You don't
garbage.
Find joy in laws. You don't find liberation in laws. You don't find education in laws. You don't find understanding in laws. But you find all those things in teaching.
No, there's an old saying, the law is an ass. And it is.
Of course, it is.
It's just a dumb ass. That's all
it is. Those who respect and revere you, they shall see me, and they will be delighted, even elated, because indeed, upon the certainty of your word, I have placed my expectation. I've taken this passage to heart. I can't wait. I can tell you, I am a celebration of this. I can't wait to meet Zod. I know that I am not nearly as smart, but can you imagine how much fun it's going to be? First of all, just to thank him for writing this to help us understand how to observe the Torah. But then say, you know, I got all these tools in the world. How did you figure this out?
Yeah, let me add something here, though. Let's do a religious copy edit. Those who fear you, they shall see me. I mean, come on, please.
Yeah, and by the way, and they're going to see me, and they're going to be delighted with their fear.
Yeah, because they fear me so much. They're going to be delighted.
So those who respect and revere you, they're the ones who are going to see Dod, and we're going to be delighted. I can't wait to see Dod. I want to tell you, the first individual I want to see is Dad. But after I have seen Dad, the next person I want to see is Dod.
Moshe.
Can't wait to see him. And what is Dod saying? Because of all of this, I know for certain I'm going to be there, and you know for certain you're going to be there, and you know we're going to all be delighted when we're there together. Well, gentlemen, we have come to the end of our hour and a half, and I haven't had to do this in a long time, but I do have a technician here, and he's been here for some time. I do need to leave you, but...
Okay, well, it's been a pleasure. I've been informed listening to us in New York, by the way.
I can tell you there are very, very, very few things that I like better than the 119th Psalm, but particularly the Yod stanza. So we're on really great material. Can't wait to return to it next week.
Sounds like a plan.
All right, well, have a good night.
All right, well, thank you. Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate you.